96 Cents and Symposium presents session number 356. Who Done It? The Nagging Mystery of Brigham Young's Last Moments. A paper by Samuel W. Taylor.
Hello and good afternoon. Welcome to Sunstone Symposium. My name is Lane Badger and I'm one of the chairs of this particular session. And this session is basically entitled Who Done It? The Nagging Mystery of Brigham Young's Last Moments. And a majority of the session will consist of Mr. Samuel Taylor here reading his paper, discussing Brigham Young and potential martyrdom and assassination and whatnot, and his paper will be read. Let me give you a little background information about Mr. Taylor, and his wonderful daughter is here on the front to help me if I make a mistake. He is the author of Tailor-Made Tales. He was born in Provo, Utah in 1905. He attended Brigham Young Academy until he was expelled for writing a report about bootleggers who were paying their tuition, students who were bootleggers and used bootleg money to pay their tuition. And when he was pressed for the names of the perpetrators, he did not reveal his sources and was thus expelled from Brigham Young Academy. His love interest took him down to California, where he was married, and he began a career as a short story writer, and he wrote for such he was printed in such publications as Saturday Evening Post. He was developing a very successful and well-known career from the time of 1930 to 1941, at which time he became enlisted in World War II, as many people did, and he went over into the European theater, and there he worked for the public relations branch of the Army Air Force. And one of the wonderful benefits he had in that situation was that he had had permanent travel orders, and he was able to go and see many areas and situations. And I'm sure that's a whole nother presentation. He returned from the war in about 1945, I believe, and upon his return, he was soon met and ushered into the Disney Entertainment Corporation, and he worked for them as a writer, also writing plays and books and short stories and things of this nature, of it, like the entertainment value. So we're very fortunate to have Mr. Taylor up here today from California with his daughter, and we're interested to hear his paper and what he has to offer. He's a bit of a slow reader, so I've heard, and I don't know what the politically correct term for that would be, like reading Lagargo or something. But anyway, he'll be reading his paper to us, and after he is finished, we can do some question and answer, and because of Mr. Taylor's hearing deficit, I will somewhat intermediate and recall the questions back. So without any more time, Mr. Samuel Taylor.
Can you hear me all right? Well, first, this is a cane, and when I first got it, the doctor told me I could put the cane away in July. But he didn't say which July. So here it is, August again, and I'm looking forward to next July. whodunit? The nagging mystery of Brigham Young's last moments. Brigham Young took sick on a Thursday evening and died a week later on Wednesday afternoon, 29 August 1877. At the time, there were persistent rumors that he had been poisoned. A century later, the mystery surrounding his terminal sickness is still a matter of speculation among historians and scholars. In common with other sensitive subjects, there are two exactly opposite accounts of the cause of Brigham's death. The official Salt Lake posture was, and has always been, that no mystery exists. In order to satisfy the feelings of our readers and answer numerous inquiries considering the particulars of the last sickness of our late beloved President Brigham Young, the Deseret News replied 2 days after Brigham's demise. It published an account of the week's sickness prepared by attending physicians and others who were present during the last hours. That's from the Deseret News, 31 August 1877. However, the report, in the light of modern medical knowledge, raises nagging questions that the cause wasn't cholera morbus attributed to a meal of green corn and peaches. In fact, while my personal medical library relies heavily on the Encyclopedia Britannica and Roberts' Theory and Practice of Medicine, Philadelphia, 1874, it was reading the last moments which alerted me to my suspicions that Brigham Young's death didn't result from natural causes, but that he had been done in by means most foul. It seemed obvious from the reports also that the attending physicians realized that the patient had been poisoned and were helpless to do anything except administer opiates to reduce the pain while waiting for the end. If this was so, it opened a field of historical research into a subject hitherto neglected or suppressed. Final chapter to the story of a man whose life has received most exhaustive research and publicity in all other aspects. If Brigham Young died of poison, we must ask, Who done it? How was it done? Why was it done? Among Mormon scholars and historians, there were persistent rumors of foul play. Yet on so sensitive a subject, nobody had been bold enough to publish documentation. And so I took my shattered lance and spurred on to tilt at the windmill. I began by discussing the case with Mormon physicians, with a Mormon physician. He expressed interest and agreed to attempt a diagnosis based on the last moments. I furnished him a copy and waited for his report. That was 1970, and I am still waiting. He has yet to mention the subject again to say yes, no, or maybe. My brother Raymond, who knew practically everybody in Utah, took up the lance. He was acquainted with several history buffs who had gathered material on the mystery. However, they kept their information close to the vest. Raymond also admitted the last moments to several active LDS doctors for an opinion. Results were uniform, complete silence. Quite obviously, this was a sensitive subject, which meant that to run counter to the official story would be negative thinking, possibly the greatest sin of the modern culture, except for drinking coffee. Therefore, I went outside the active circle, but remained within the area of understanding. I submitted the last moments to a prominent Sacramento physician of Mormon extraction, whose only contact with the church was through the monthly visit of his home teachers. It also helped that he happened to be my brother-in-law, Dr. Max Dimmick. Assistant clinical professor, obstetrics and gynecology, University of California Medical School at Davis. He undertook the diagnosis of last moments also a century after the death of the patient. After communicating with pathologists, he reported that what you would like to know is who had access to his lunch that day. It must have been arsenic, and it had to be acute rather than chronic. Poisoning. He discussed the possibility of typhoid, paratyphoid, or bacilli, dysentery, dismissing them because in such cases, he should have been ill over a prolonged period of time. As for cholera, forget it. He enclosed tear sheets regarding arsenic from a medical test, saying, read the enclosed on acute poisoning, and I'm sure you agree the picture fits. It certainly did fit. However, during the period in question, arsenic was not only a part of popular poisoning agent, but was a major ingredient in embalming fluid. I asked Dr. Dimmick whether by exhuming Brigham's remains, it would be possible to ascertain if he was poisoned with the embalming fluid penetrate the bones and hair after death, as the poison would have during life. He replied, it took about 7 days after ingestion of the arsenic to get in the bones and the hair, as the body deposited in an attempt to eliminate the poison. He added that, I talked with two of our pathologists, and they told me embalming fluid would not contaminate the bones or hair. I published these facts in a footnote in a book, which evidently shook up Salt Lake, but did nothing to change the official story. The book was The Kingdom of Nothing, the biography of John Taylor. Meanwhile, I was charging a windmill. Dr. Dimmick had pointed out that just one hair of Brigham's head or a sliver of fingernail or a fragment of bone would be sufficient with modern methods to ascertain if the poison indeed was arsenic. So after hearing that a bracelet made of Brigham's hair was on exhibit at the Beehive House, I made a beeline for it on my next visit to Salt Lake. However, the hair of the bracelet evidently came from Brigham in his middle years, for there were no silver threads among the gold. Actually, auburn. Also, the date was indicated by a notation that the gold bands were from the 49er diggings. I submitted the last moments to Whitaker Husk to Whitaker Hospital, where my nephew was administrator. He submitted it to doctors on his staff, and the consensus was that Brigham died of arsenic poisoning. One doctor noted that in lasting awake, Brigham must have been a tough son of a bitch. Indeed he was. But this remark brought up a new angle of the mystery. Had there been more than one dose, had someone with access both to the food and the sick room put arsenic in Brigham's lunch on Thursday, then his medication during the week of his sickness. Pure speculation, but one evening a retired physician called around whose grandfather had been a doctor in attendance to Brigham's last moments. We had a most interesting discussion, and you must accept or reject my report of it. However, I don't have his permission to use his name. He told me that it was known in his own family that Brigham died of poison. His grandfather and the other doctors were aware of the situation, he said, and simply made the patient as comfortable as possible. He also told me that he had talked with the wife of Apostle John A. Witso, who was a young, and she said the fact that Brigham died of poison was well known in her family. As to who done it, he believed that Brigham, old, sick, and tired of life, simply had taken a lethal dose. I pointed out the two things which conflicted with the suicide theory. One was Brigham's religion. By suicide, according to his belief, he would deny himself the higher glory of the hereafter. The other reason, which my visitor hadn't considered, was the possibility that Brigham Young had planned to form a young family dynasty to rule the church. T.B.S. Stenhouse had accused him of this in the book Rocky Mountain Saints, evidence being that Brigham had secretly ordained three of his sons as apostles at a tender age. With this in mind, writing in 1873, Stenhouse revealed that in 1855, Brigham Young ordered a son, John W. Young, an apostle, when John W. was a boy of 10. Subsequently, in 1864, he added two more sons, Brigham Young Jr., Young Briggy, and Joseph A. Young. Ordination of the three young boys was confirmed in the internal press by Reed's C. Durham and Stephen Heath in succession of the church presidency, Salt Lake, Bookcraft, 1870. Also by Church Almanac, 1975. The significance of this action is that the senior members of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles will succeed to the office of church president upon the death of the incumbent. However, if this was Brigham's plan, it backfired. The Quorum of the 12 was outraged at learning of the secret ordination of the boys, and only one of the three, young Brigham, was accepted into the 12. However, by 1877, the last year of Brigham's life, he was accused by the Salt Lake Tribune of planning to abdicate in favor of young Brigham. At the time, the first LDS temple in Utah had been completed at St. George, and its dedication scheduled during the annual conference of the, in April. Brigham, 76, had grown old and confirmed, stiffened by arthritis and neurology and respiratory troubles. A recent attack of gout made walking impossible. Even with the aid of a crutch and cane, he was carried around to the various meetings in an armchair constructed by Howard Cottam to accommodate the prophet's obese girth. Probably prostrate troubles resulted in the use of a castor to relieve his bladder. Brigham Young, quite obviously, within the sheer and yellow leaf. The Tribune said that for several years people had joked that he was just well enough to sit up and get married again now and then. The Gentile press had freely predicted that the dedication conference, at the dedication conference, Brigham would abdicate in favor of young Brigham. The Tribune was so sure of a change of leadership would take place that it dubbed the event the Abdication Conference. The ambiguous ranking of Apostle John Taylor was another evidence that abdication might have been planned. Brigham had succeeded to the church presidency by being president of the Quorum of the Twelve. Yet for the past 3 years, when Taylor was senior member of the quorum, he was pointedly sustained at conference as a member of the 12 rather than its presidency. Brigham hadn't abdicated at St. George Conference, very probably because of the recent execution of John D. Lee, scapegoat of the Mountain Meadows massacre 20 years previously, and the sensation caused by his confessions, written after he had been betrayed by Brigham in receiving the death sentence. At Mountain Meadows, near St. George, Mormon fanatics and Indian help had waylaid and massacred a California bound wagon train, killing more than 120 men, women, and children. While the saints tried to keep the lid on, the Gentile clamor for justice finally was settled when just white man, one white man, and more than 60 who participated was tried and convicted. Lee had been executed at the site of Mountain Meadows just 2 weeks before the dedication conference. The nationwide uproar at this time could have caused Brigham to remain in control had he planned abdication at St. George. The Tribune, however, predicted that he would abdicate in favor of young Brigham at the next conference in October. But Brigham died 29 August. Most certainly, if Brigham had planned to abdicate to establish a young dynasty, he wouldn't have suicided just 5 weeks prior to the October conference. His 30 years reign as prophet, seer, and revelator had given him enormous prestige and unquestioned power. He could have controlled the succession to presidency only by personally stepping down in favor of his selected replacement. Dead, the matter was of succession was beyond his control. After he discussed these matters, my visitor changed his mind about suicide. The question of who done it was still open. Rising to the defense of the official story, an LDS doctor, Lewis E. Bush, Jr., wrote a paper in 1978, Brigham Young in Life and Death, a Medical Overview, Journal of Mormon History. He takes the thesis that physicians attending Brigham were completely unaware of the poison symptoms, and that death was due to appendicitis. When I relayed this to Dr. Max Dimmick, his reply was caustic. If a medical student diagnosed appendicitis from Brigham's symptoms, he said, he'd flunk out of school. Actually, the Bush article as a whole is an excellent paper on an obscure subject, full of tidbits such as in middle life, Brigham's health improved in giving up tobacco, and that at this time he required a very handsome set of dentures. However, I'm afraid it belongs to the school known as New Mormon History, characterized by a veritable avalanche of footnotes, but too often defending the faith than following the fact. Juanita Brooks, the historian's historian of Mormonism, defined the apologist contributor to the internal press thusly. They aren't historians at all. They are lawyers proving a case. It just wouldn't do to admit that Brigham was murdered. For the immediate question arises, who done it and why? Who done it? Well,
Dad, can I take over and have you sit down and rest, and then you'll be ready for questions?
Well,
are you getting a little tired?
I'm not tired.
You're not? Are you sure?
Who's that?
Have a drink of water, at least. You're killing me. You should at least have a little water. I couldn't do that for 45 minutes.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Who done it? Well, who had access to the Heavenly Garden compound? Who would have given Brigham his medication in the small hours and sat with him throughout the night? Who would have been admitted without question to the sick room at all times? The answer is inevitable. Members of his immediate family, in particular the nurses, about whom the last moment says nothing. Yet with vomiting and purging being almost continuous the first few days, the patient needed a great deal of attention. The women of the household would have been busy with bedpans and changing sheets and with keeping the patient as clean and comfortable as possible. In looking for someone who had been in a position and with a motive to have put arsenic in Brigham's lunch on Thursday, and very probably to have also given additional doses at the bedside during the week of his sickness, we must examine Those were very close. We must zero in on the suspect who was entirely above suspicion. Who done it? Quite obviously, the case to cast to this mystery falls into the island subject beloved by authors of murder books, known in the trade as whodunits. The guilty person had to be someone living in the lion beehive house complex. Dr. Max Dimmick pointed out that the swelling of Brigham's abdomen and the later changes of the sickness is suggestive of peritonitis and ileus, resulting in symptoms of appendicitis. However, this doesn't necessarily mean the condition was caused by a ruptured appendix, because the corrosive action of arsenic may erode the mascara until perforation can and does appear. This in turn would ensure peritonitis and ileus. The violent vomiting and purging of the first few days would be typical of poisoning, but certainly not of appendicitis. The muscular twitching described here are consistent with arsenic poisoning. Evidently, the diagnosis of appendicitis, Dr. Dimmick concluded, can be made only by ignoring completely the first days of Brigham's Young.
Let me take a turn, and then I'll turn it back to you. Just sit down a minute. Your legs are tired.
You mean you'll read it?
Yeah, I will. Sit down right there.
Well, all right.
Then you can answer the questions. You're getting a little tired. Just right there.
With the advance of medical knowledge, appendicitis has often replaced the original diagnosis of cholera morbus, brought on by eating green corn and peaches, as the cause of death. Leonard J. Arrington, director of the Church History Division, replied to a letter asking, "Is there any evidence that Brigham Young was murdered?" by sending a copy of the Bush article and assuring the writer that it conclusively demonstrates that our longtime belief that he died from appendicitis is quite true. Upon seeing the Bush article, I sent it together with the last moments to Dr. Max Dimmick. I also forwarded copies to Whittier Hospital, and from here, J.W. Springer, M.D. pathologist, replied, "From the available material, it appears that Brigham Young died as a result of ingesting arsenic. This certainly does not resemble appendicitis." Meanwhile, Dr. Dimmick consulted with other physicians with symptoms such as those described for Brigham Young. Diarrhea is rare, and continual vomiting and purging are not described as symptoms for appendicitis. In summary, one can say Brigham Young did not die of appendicitis. That he had a massive, generalized gastroenteritis is evident and is compatible with acute arsenic poisoning. He appended medical literature from three sources, calling attention to the date, 1901, of an American textbook of pathology, when I'm certain they saw more arsenic poison in that time frame. This deals... Another reference discusses acute appendicitis from the Davis-Christopher textbook of surgery in 1977. This text mentions that the vomiting and diarrhea, which are persistent and profuse in most cases of arsenic poisoning. Clinical Toxicology, another book, states that vomiting, severe abdominal pain, and diarrhea soon follow ingestion of arsenic. Pain in the limbs, headache, convulsions, muscular weakness, and unconsciousness indicate an effect of arsenic upon the central nervous system. Symptoms are numbness, burning, tingling, or itching. These are followed by muscular twitching, gross tremors with muscular atrophy and paralysis. This could be an exact description of Brigham's symptoms. All of which brings us back to whodunit. We must remember that there would have been an impelling motive for such an act. Who were the enemies of Brigham Young? Their name is Legion. No man in his position of power, who had ruled Utah as a theocracy for 30 years, could avoid enemies. This is quite aside from the family complications of a man who married 53 wives. Yet Brigham was aware of outside enemies and fully prepared against them. If men did penetrate the fortress, as did two Lee sons, it would be impossible to poison only the food eaten by Brigham. Who had the most to gain? Offhand, we must look at the man next in line to succeed Brigham's office, John Taylor. Had Brigham lived another 5 weeks to October conference, had he abdicated in favor of his sons, John Taylor never would have become president of the church. Taylor was known as the manacled giant, who had lived for 40 years in the shadow of Brigham's power. Only by the prophet's death could Taylor shake off the shackles. However, we can rule him out. Quite aside from his character, principles, and respect for Brigham's position, Taylor never was socially close to him as a person. The two men worked together in church affairs, but were never friends. Taylor would have had no opportunity to tamper with the food or medication. This narrows the field to the menage of Brigham's own family and close relatives. It might be appalling to suggest such a scandal in the family of a sainted figure. However, it is a fact that one murder in five is committed by a member of the immediate family, and almost half of all murders by relatives, family, or close friends. The Young family had its tensions, as the subsequent brouhaha over the settlement of Brigham's estate proved. The complications of plural marriage were astronomical. Who of this select group would have both opportunity and an immediate, impelling, and overwhelming motive? Who done it? Call her Ms. X. Inasmuch as charges were never filed, I cannot name her now. However, if you really do want to know, her identity can be found among the pieces of this whodunit which lie waiting in available material for any interested scholar, historian, Western buff, whodunit fan, trivia freak, or windmill tilter who wishes to fit the puzzle together. My cards are on the table. I've had no access to confidential sources or sensitive materials. No safes were open to me. What is important is not the actual name of Ms. X, but her relationship to Brigham Young. In an association of a dozen years, her initial dislike had grown to intense loathing. But what drove her to the corner drugstore for a little calomel salve, please, Mr. Goodby, and, oh yes, a dime's worth of arsenic to get rid of the gophers. Motive, the threat to her daughter, a beautiful girl of 17. At this period in Deseret, when an old man began losing his steam, he was dealt a young girl as a plural wife to revitalize him. Brigham did the dealing. His permission was essential. While a special exaltation in the hereafter was promised to a nubile maiden who married an old man on earth, to her mother it was a monstrous situation which made her flesh crawl. When an appeal to Brigham failed, her only recourse was to eliminate the man in charge. Modus operandi. The sugar bowl. Brigham liked to eat with members of his menage. How then to single him out for a lethal dose without endangering others? Sugar was a prized commodity in frontier Utah. The members of the household sweetened their tea with honey. Only Brigham and special guests used sugar. He also liked a cup of tea in mid-afternoon. Again, the sugar bowl. The contents mixed with a tasteless white powder. In the event more than one dose was required, because Brigham was a tough son of a bitch, consider the tea served to settle his stomach during his week's sickness, and also the medication, a mixture of brandy and milk. There was ample opportunity. Whether or not the identity of the culprit was suspected, I have no way of knowing, though her unhappy fate subsequently would indicate either that she was tormented by conscience or harassed by family rumor. And so the case stands. Officially, Brigham Young died of appendicitis. Impartial medical evidence says arsenic poisoning, and the full facts may never be known. Thank you.
I would like to thank the Taylors for their paper and presentation. And now, if you have any questions, we'll relay them and talk about them. Yes, what is your question? Who was it? He wants to know who was it.
Read the article. This is abridged from the full article, which will be published in Sunstone. That contains considerable information which I couldn't read in an hour. So,
The
name is the same, the title.
The name of the lady that poisoned him, is that in your article?
No.
Well, so much for resubscribing to Sunstone. Alan, what is your question?
Comment, actually.
Comment.
Medical forensics examiners and medical historians have determined that Napoleon Bonaparte was poisoned by several incremental, very small doses of arsenic. In those days, in the 19th century, people would cut off locks of the hair and give them away as gifts. Joseph Smith did this at the time. Bonaparte gave away several locks of his hair. Forensics people examined his hair and found many, many, many times more parts of arsenic than would be in a normal body. Then they went back to his journals and they found that he wrote every day when he was in his declining years, his illness and his symptoms. And the medical historian area that his symptoms were really that of arsenic poisoning. And then the other people would determine who was in the household, who was likely to have a motive, who had access, and pretty much been determined who it was that administered the legal doses and put Napoleon when he was in time. I'm just presenting this because it's a parallel and historical precedent, and it's probably not just Napoleon, but maybe other people. I don't have any comments on this particular paper other than I've read Lester Bush's, and I too, at the time, was persuaded by Lester's argument, but I think these other comments by actual doctors are pretty revealing too.
And Napoleon had two wives, didn't he? I was a girlfriend and a wife.
Well,
that's the danger.
Watch out for women, is that a
strange Women and white sugar. Okay, question.
Has anyone ever proposed that this grave be exhumed? And if that were ever possible, could subsequent analysis of the remains make such a determination?
Okay. Has anyone ever thought to exhume Brigham Young's body? And if they did exhume his body because they embalm in arsenic, can we determine if, could we be able to determine if he was?
Well, I treated this in the article. Dr. Dimmick said that it would not permeate
the interior,
the bones and the hair.
So it could be proven.
Yes.
Go get a shovel.
Yeah.
Okay, does that answer that question?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Any more questions of sorts?
But has there ever been, I didn't have one question answered. Have there ever been any serious movements to do, to perform such an exhumation?
Has there ever been an attempt to exhume Brigham Young's body and look at it?
Well, who would they exhume Brigham Young's body? I asked you.
We could get a fund. it could be non-profit.
Zachary Taylor, I believe. Zachary Taylor, because they suspect that he's been poisoned. And well, they concluded he was, and then there was a movement to exhume another president. I can't remember.
I guess call 1-800 dig him up. Okay. Yes, question.
I wouldn't think that would be very flattering to the church for
So I think we're going to have to tunnel underneath the cemetery, and they won't be the wiser. Question.
Sorry, if you feel uncomfortable about giving the name, how about the initials?
SWT.
Okay. Any more questions? Yes, sir. Question.
Are we really sure that Brigham Young is buried where he's said to be buried?
Are we sure that Brigham Young is buried where it says Brigham Young grave on First Avenue? Are we sure of that or not sure?
Well, will the sun come up in the morning? Yeah, Brigham Young's grave is sacrosanct. There's no chance.
There's no chance that he's there in that grave. I've heard that before, that is just a phony grave.
Really? I did not know that. So, like, he could be in the Caribbean with Elvis and JFK?
That's why nobody knows where
he's
going to be. Or Harry Potter.
Really? Okay. Well,
if there was a question,
I want my money back from that tour of the RLDS thing. All right.
If there was a question about his death, then for sure they would not invite that. The church couldn't afford that kind of publicity.
I know. Well, they don't want to look bad. Okay, well, folks, our time is up. Any last-minute closing questions or jokes? Okay, are we all awake? All right. Thank you, and good afternoon. Thank you. Hey, thank you very much. That was a wonderful put-together argument with thought and research. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.